Post photos and more on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Find us at TCH Radio.
Find lots of information about us at children'shour.org.
Our theme music is written by C.K. Barlow.
The Children's Hour is distributed by the Children's Hour Incorporated and the Public Radio Exchange, PRX, and the Pacifica Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to The Children's Hour, Kids Public Radio.
Dirtbag and KBOO Community Radio comes from our members and from One Green World, a family-owned and operated nursery off Southeast Foster on 134th Avenue in Portland, providing a selection of fruiting trees, vines, shrubs, and vegetables and supplies. More information is available at onegreenworld.com.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to another edition of From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly series that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we come with a quick, clean program on Howard Zinn. Our co-producer and mixer, Mark Torres, has been ill this week, so we're putting a self-contained 59-minute speech of Howard Zinn, Virtual Optimism, the Other Side of American History.
And there was a guy named Charles Hutto who actually participated in the massacre years later. Well, he said, I was 19 years old, and I'd always been told to do what the grown-ups told me to do. But now I'll tell my sons, if the government calls, to use their own judgment, to forget about authority, to use their own conscience. I wish somebody had told me that before I went to Vietnam. I didn't know. Now I don't think there should be even a thing called war, because it messes up a person's mind.
Here it says this was from November 1992, so this is 20 years old. Noted social historian Howard Zinn presents an informal talk about United States history from the bottom up. His personal view of history changed following his experiences during the Vietnam War, and he had become interested in the causes of war, the nature of enemy soldiers, the laborers who built the railroads, factory laborers, the poor, and the unrepresented. We pause to remember Howard Zinn, who passed away January 27, 2010, and was a great friend of the Pacifica Radio Archives. And what better way to go through our Memorial Day weekend but to get a history lesson from the man who wrote The People's History of the United States. Here is Howard Zinn.
I didn't go into history just because it was interesting. You know, history is interesting. Everybody knows that. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. History is boring, too. It depends, right? But history can be interesting. But I didn't go into history just because it was interesting, you know, doing investigative work and digging in the archives and finding old letters and, you know, all that stuff that historians do, which is fun. But I didn't go into it for that reason, because it was fun. I didn't start studying history until I had done these other things, you know, until I had, you know, worked in a shipyard for 3 years and been in the Air Force and knocked around at various jobs. And so, you know, I became a freshman in college at the age of 27. I was married and we had children, and I say that to impress you with the weight of my experience. And so by the time I started studying history, I knew why I wanted to study it, and it was not just because it was interesting. I didn't want to simply do as I had seen historians do, that is sort of go into the past, you know, and never come out, you know. Because it's easy to do that, you know. It's interesting there. Why leave? I wanted to go into the past. I was interested in history, but I wanted to come out and see what was going on in the world and connect what I was learning about the past with what was happening. Because of my growing up, I was interested in I was interested in why some people were rich and some people were poor. My father worked very, very hard and had little to show for it. I wanted to be able to understand that, you know. Ever since that day, I've always really terribly resented it when somebody would say, in America, if you work hard, you've heard that before, you know, you will make it. And if you haven't made it, it must mean you haven't worked hard. I wanted to learn more about the class nature of American society. I always hesitate before I use the word class, you know, because it's a very dangerous word to use. And all the politicians always telling us, let's not arouse class hatred. I was aroused that way when I was very young, and I haven't been able to get over it since, you see. But I was interested in war and what happens in war and why wars take place and what in the world good are they. So I wanted the answers to some of these questions, you know, when I began to study history. And it occurred to me, how undemocratic this history was, and how odd it was that here in this presumably democratic country, that our history was so undemocratic, that our history was a history of elites, and that the people were left out of the history. And in some way, there was some connection between an undemocratic history and an undemocratic society, because if you generation after generation reproduce an undemocratic history, a history that concentrates on what the great white men do at the top, then what you do is produce generation after generation a passive citizenry. A citizenry that expects that all the important decisions in society are going to be made by the President of the United States and the Congress and the Supreme Court. Therefore, the only thing that citizens have to do is to go to the polls every 2 or 4 years. The supreme act of citizenship is to go to the polls every 2 or 4 years, to go into that little booth and relieve yourself, you know. Something, you know, it seemed to me fundamentally undemocratic about that. And then I remember, reading something by George Orwell which epitomized that. Orwell said that whoever controls the past controls the future. And whoever controls the present controls the past. So whoever is in charge of our society can decide what our history will look like. And by deciding what our history will look like, they will decide our future. That made history very important to me, because it meant that history was not disengaged from society, that to create a more democratic history meant that that you were at least playing some part in trying to create a more democratic society. So I found I had to read history on my own, and this is what most people find, that you know, they learn more when they get out of class, right? You learn more when you start reading on your own. And so I started reading labor history, because I had been, at the age of 18, I was a member of the Industrial Union of Marine and Shipbuilding Workers of America, which we called UMSWA, which sounds like an Indian name, but actually it's just one of those, you know, union names, which, you know, unions were never good at, you know, PR. So I was interested in labor history, and I got interested in, and that set me on the road to sort of learning about that history that I hadn't learned about in school, brought me into contact with all sorts of people and all sorts of events that were missing from the textbooks. There's nothing in the textbooks about Mother Jones. I encountered her when I, not in person, I mean, a lot of people are very suspicious when I say, you know, things like that. They look at me and, yeah, I guess he did. But no, I encountered her when I read about, for the first time, about the Colorado coal strike of 1913-1914 and the Ludlow Massacre, all of that. Things are absolutely absent from my historical training. And right, and I had gone right through the PhD in history. I mean, how much higher can you go than that? But nothing about Mother Jones, and nothing about the Colorado coal strike, and very little about the IWW. And so I was very interested in the fact that workers had to do what was done in Colorado and what was done in so many other places, what was done in Lawrence in 1912 and on the railroads again and again in the 1890s. They had to go out on strike in order to secure some modicum of improvement in their working conditions, because there was all this emphasis on laws passed by Congress, the Constitution of the United States, that bulwark of democracy, the thing which we celebrate and celebrate and celebrate. But the Constitution, the President, the Congress, the Supreme Court, they were not there when workers had to cut down their hours from 16 hours to 12 hours to 10 hours to 8 hours. There's nothing in the Constitution, nothing in the institutions of this presumably democratic country that enabled workers to do away with a 16-hour day. They had to do that on their own. Sure, there's the Bill of Rights, which gave certain, you know, political rights and certain, you know, all know about that, freedom of speech and press. Well, that's another story. A very complicated story. But nothing in the Constitution about economic rights. Well, it teaches you something about the value of institutions and the importance of the powers up there in Washington to see that when it comes to something as crucial as the most elementary biological needs of working people, of how hard they work, how long they work, what conditions they work under, what wages they get, that they're on their own. So the institutions of the country aren't there for them. They have to do it for themselves. That's a very, very important lesson in history. My first teaching job, well, my first real teaching job, I had a few unreal teaching jobs. My first real teaching job was in Atlanta, Georgia, Spelman College, College for Black Women. That time they called it a Negro College. I guess they still do, United Negro College Fund and all of that. And I taught there for 7 years. And that was interesting for me and useful for me in the development of my approach to history, because you can't live in a black community for 7 years, and certainly not in the midst of the years of the civil rights movement, and come away looking at history the way you did before. And then you realize that history to black people looks different than history to white people, just as history to women looks different than history to men, and history to Native Americans look, you know, right? History looks different.
You were listening to the Pacifica Radio Archives hero Howard Zinn on From the Vault. For more information about this program or other materials in our archive of Howard Zinn, please contact us at 1-800-735-0230, or you can go online at fromthevaultradio.org, and you can also search our collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. And now back to Mr. Zinn.
I wanted to write about the Mexican War, not from the standpoint of General Winfield Scott and his triumphant march into Mexico City, but from the standpoint of the soldiers who had volunteered for the Mexican War, not volunteered because they knew what the war was about, volunteered for the same reason the most poor kids volunteer for the military, out of desperation with their lives, out of chance to make something of their lives, and about what was their viewpoint. Well, you know, they're the ones who were with Winfield Scott on the march towards Mexico City, the culmination of the war, and then on the road to Mexico City, seven regiments of them deserted and went back home. I want to tell the story of the Mexican War from the standpoint of the Massachusetts Volunteers. Again, the word volunteer always has to be in quotation marks. Who came back from the war, well, half of them came back alive, and attended a dinner in their honor. And their commanding officer got up to speak, and they booed him off the platform, you see. And I wanted to tell the story of wars from the standpoint of the enemy, the other side. Well, that's something new. Yeah, let's look at war from the other side. Let's see how the Mexican War looks to the Mexicans. Let's see how they feel about us taking 40% of their territory. I wanted to tell the story of American industrial progress, not in the way I had learned it, that I had learned it as a great triumph. That period between the Civil War and World War I, the period of when the United States became a great industrial power, and I remember being excited by that as a high school kid. What a wonderful time it was. We became a great and prosperous nation, and all those railroad tracks were laid, and all those steel mills went up, and the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific joined, and we had the Transcontinental Railroad, and the president drove the Golden Spike in, and wow, what a moment. I still remember that Hollywood made a film called Union Pacific about that, you know, and there were these two railroad lines moving closer. You can imagine the suspense building up. Will they really meet? No. And of course, that's in the background. In the foreground, there's a man and a woman moving close, right? But I wanted to tell the story of this great industrial progress from the standpoint of the people who worked on those railroads. The Chinese and Irish immigrants who worked in the heat and in the cold on those railroads and died by the thousands working on those railroads. The people who worked in Rockefeller's oil refineries. The girls who went to work in the textile mills of New England at the age of 11 and died at the age of 25. That was a different story than the story of exultant progress, of industrial civilization. And it made me think about how much the progress of the human race has been measured in quantities of steel ingots and miles of railroad tracks laid without any consideration for what happened to human beings in the course of this so-called progress. That was a different way of, you know, looking at history. And I wanted to tell the story of how people had fought back against this, because I didn't want to see if, when you looked into it, people were not simply passive recipients of all of this. They struggled, they fought back, they resisted. Because it was interesting to me that, you know, despite the great odds, people resisted and resisted and resisted. The Indians, fighting against tremendous odds, resisted. The Seminole Indians of Florida fought for years and years and years before they were subdued. The Indians on the Great Plains, again, against tremendous odds, against all these modern weapons of the United States Army. Working people resisted their conditions. Well, right from the beginning of the colonial period, there were strikes. Black slaves resisted and revolted again and again. The colonial period, the period before the American Revolution, was full of class conflict, full of tenants rebelling against their landlords, of working people during the Revolution asking the question, what are we going to get out of this revolution, and why are we being conscripted to fight against the English when the rich can pay their way? This was not just true of the Civil War, it was true of the Revolutionary War. The rich could pay their way out of the military service. And there were draft riots against this during the Revolutionary War. I was encouraged to see how much resistance there was, see what spunk people had, and what courage people had. And recalled to me just things that I had seen myself when in the South during the years of the Civil Rights Movement, the remarkable courage of people under murderous conditions. And what could be more murderous than Mississippi in the early 1960s? But I remember a black Mississippian named Sam Block, who was one of the everybody who was in SNCC and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the South knew him, he went with somebody to register them to vote in Greenwood, Mississippi, and to try to register a black person to vote in Greenwood, Mississippi was a very, very daring act, you know. And imagine daring act to register to vote in a country that had passed the 15th Amendment almost 100 years ago, and where presumably the great federal government of the United States stood sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and yet it was an act of ultimate courage to try to register somebody to vote in Mississippi. And so the sheriff confronted Sam Block, and somebody standing by sort of made note on their conversation. The sheriff to Sam Block, "Nigger, where you from?" Block, "I'm a native of Mississippi." Sheriff, "I know all the niggers here." Sam Block, "Do you know any colored people?" The sheriff spits on him. The sheriff, "I'll give you till tomorrow to get out of here." Sam Block, "If you don't want to see me here, you better pack up and leave, because I'll be here." But, I think of all the people who, protested against war, in every war that the United States has fought has had protesters against that war. I think, remember reading about Helen Keller protesting against World War I. Again, in school, what had I learned about Helen Keller in school in my history books? Now that she was this, this brave kid who overcame her handicaps and learned all these languages and how nice it was that she was able to do that. But they never told me in school that she was a radical, that she was a socialist, that she was a picketer and a demonstrator. She made a speech at Carnegie Hall just before the United States entered the European War, World War I. She said, "Strike against war, for without you no battles can be fought. Strike against manufacturing shrapnel and gas bombs and all other tools of murder. Strike against preparedness that means death and misery to millions of human beings. Be not dumb, obedient slaves in an army of destruction. Be heroes in an army of construction." Mark Twain, speaking out on the Philippine War in the early part of the 20th century. What do you learn about Mark Twain in school? Well, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, and yes, a great literary figure. But Mark Twain was a eloquent critic of what the United States was doing abroad. And he commented on the Philippine War, "We have pacified some thousands of the islanders and buried them, destroyed their fields, burned their villages, and turned their widows and orphans out of doors, furnished heartbreak by exile to some dozens of disagreeable patriots, subjugated the remaining 10 millions by benevolent assimilation," which is the pious new name of the musket. "We have acquired property in the 300 concubines and other slaves of our business partner and hoisted our protecting flag over that swag. And so by these providences of God," and the phrase is the government's, not mine, "we are a world power." And I've always been especially interested in GIs who protested against war, whether they deserted or whether they had second thoughts about war, as I did, because I was an eager bombardier when I was in the Air Force. And it was only after the war that I began to think about what I had done and the bombs I had dropped and where they had fallen and who the victims were and what all that was about. I read about the My Lai massacre, that sort of pinnacle of atrocities in the Vietnam War, but representing many others, you see. But there were people there who had second thoughts. There were people who at the time refused to participate. We know about Callie and the others, but there were GIs who refused to participate in that. And then there was the warrant officer who flew his helicopter down and tried to stop what was going on. And there was a guy named Charles Hutto who actually participated in the massacre and later, years later, said, "I was 19 years old and I'd always been told to do what the grown-ups told me to do. But now I'll tell my sons, if the government calls, to use their own judgment, to forget about authority, to use their own conscience. I wish somebody had told me that before I went to Vietnam. I didn't know. Now I don't think there should be even a thing called war, because it messes up a person's mind." Now maybe there's something wrong with me, that I'm always looking in history for acts of rebellion and resistance and indignation and dissent, you see. But I look for them because they're the things that are left out of history. And they're real, they're there. And they, even if they represent a small part of what happens in any historical event, it seems to me in some way they represent the essence of it, because they represent the future. They represent something that will grow and not, you know, decrease. Carter, after the Russians invaded Afghanistan, invoked the draft again. Some of you may remember that. Registration for the draft. About 10% of those who were supposed to register did not register. That was about 800,000 people. And somebody wrote a letter, a woman. 36 years ago, I stood in front of the crematorium. The ugliest force in the world had promised itself that I should be removed from the cycle of life. I survived the great guns, and with every smile of my son, they grow smaller. It is not for me, sir, to offer my son's blood as lubricant for the next generation of guns. I remove myself and my own from the cycle of death. It's interesting that when Reagan came into office in 1981, he hesitated to resume draft registration. I don't know how many of you remember that. Reagan hesitated to resume draft registration. And this was explained by Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger. Quote, "President Reagan believes that resuming the draft to meet manpower problems would lead to public unrest comparable to that in the 60s and 70s. There was an editor of the National Review who was terribly distressed at the fact that young people were not rushing to register for the draft unanimously. And he was convinced that it was the fault of the 60s. And he said, almost certainly, he was talking about a young man named Benjamin Sassway. Sassway refused to register, and he cited U.S. military intervention in El Salvador as a good reason not to register. And so he became a sort of public case. And this editor of the National Review wrote, almost certainly there was a teacher or teachers who taught Benjamin Sassway to look at American society as hypocritical, exploitative, materialistic roadblock on the path of human progress. I was very happy to read that. I was also interested in the fact that in the 80s, now I was teaching in the 80s, and everybody was saying, or a lot of people were saying, the Reagan years and student generation, quiet, it's not like the 60s, you know, the students are passive, the students are not. Well, they were judging the 80s by what they were reading in the newspapers. It's amazing how the press can create, just like they can give labels to eras, they can also give descriptions of whole blocks of people which then become self-fulfilling prophecies, or which they hope will become self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, it's a silent generation again. We're back to the 50s. Students aren't interested. I just never found that to be true. And I wasn't teaching little seminars of radical kids. I was teaching a course every semester with 400 students of all sorts. Engineering students and business students and hockey players, and I didn't find that at all. I found that my students were interested in what was going on in the world, cared about what was going on in the world, didn't find the wherewithal. They didn't find some great issue going on. There was no civil rights movement. There was no Vietnam War. But when Central American issues came up, yes, they got active on Central America. And you remember, there were things that went on hundreds of campuses all over the country on Central America, on divestment from South Africa, and so on. And my students would write, they would keep journals in my class and to express their thoughts on whatever we were discussing in class. And it was interesting to me to read these journals after reading the descriptions of this passive generation in the Time magazine. This was a woman who was a photojournalism student. She says, we seem to compare wars like we do wine. 1776 was a good year. And 1898 was a bad year. And World War II seemed to be the Dom Perignon of wars. But in the nuclear age, war can no longer be compared to wine, but to cyanide. One sip and you're dead. Another student, biology major. Do you think anything good that has happened in the world has had anything to do with government? I work in Roxbury. That's a black neighborhood in Boston. I know the government doesn't work. Not for the people of Roxbury. Not for the people anywhere. It works for people with money. Young woman. As a white middle-class person, I've never felt discriminated against, but I'll say this. If anyone ever tried to make me sit in a different schoolroom, use a different bathroom, or anything like that, I would knock them right on their ass. I mean, I marked her down, of course, for language, you know. I mean, that's really intolerable.
You were listening to the Pacifica Radio Archives hero Howard Zinn on From the Vault. For more information about this program or other materials in our archive of Howard Zinn, please contact us at 1-800-735-0230, or you can go online at fromthevaultradio.org, and you can also search our collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. And now back to Mr. Zinn.
The truth is, in my book, I don't like to say that I missed things in my book. I missed a lot of things in my book. You don't like to think that, you know, after you've written 600 pages, you've missed a lot of things. But, of course, I did. And one of the things that I missed was the struggles of Chicano people in this country. I think it came from my sort of narrow Atlantic Ocean view of things or something. Too much time in Boston. When I recently read Elizabeth Martinez's book, I don't know how many of you know it, 500 Years of Chicano History. It's a wonderful book, and it filled in for me a lot of the gaps in pointing to the amazing resistance of Chicano people all through American history and before we had the United States, you know, way back against the very early Spanish occupations southwestern part of the United States. This is the kind of history that I wanted to write about. I was interested in the fact, and I found that history could be encouraging if you didn't read history through the eyes of the traditional textbook writers if you looked in history for what people were doing and how people were reacting, that yes, that history could be actually encouraging. And what seemed to me to be true again and again was how often surprises took place in history. Well, I know there are bad surprises, but I'm talking about good surprises. I'm talking about how often in history, when you didn't expect it, suddenly people arose and did something that you didn't expect them to do. And people there were these miners in Colorado, and year after year bowed under the oppression of the Rockefeller coal mine interests in southern Colorado, and it doesn't look like they will ever be able to utter a peep because they're surrounded by men with guns. And every time a union organizer comes into town, he's gunned down or driven out and so on. And then suddenly, one day, 13,000 of them are on the march out of the tent, out of their mining shacks on strike. And this has happened again and again, you know, where working people have banded together and in the 1930s taken on the great industrial giants who supposedly invincible, the Ford Empire, the General Motors Empire, the U.S. Steel Empire, taken them on and won. What happened in the civil rights movement was a surprise. Because if a lot of people looking at the South, a lot of people looking at the South in the 1950s, well, nothing is happening. People seem to be quiet. Doesn't look like the South will ever change. Coming to Spelman College in 1956 and seeing how controlled my students were, living in the benign paternalism of this black college which is subsidized by these white philanthropists of the North, and where the students are sort of kept under reins and sign in and sign out and compulsory chapel 6 times a week, and you can't do this and you can't do that, and you know the stone wall around the campus and barbed wire at certain points, and apparently a kind of unspoken pact between the black colleges of Atlanta and the white power structure of Atlanta, like, oh, you can have your little Negro college, fine, do as you like, but stay away from the city of Atlanta. Don't interfere with our way of life in Atlanta. Atlanta at that time was as tightly segregated as Johannesburg, South Africa. And it didn't look like anything would happen. And then suddenly one day, the students were over the wall and into the city and sitting in everywhere and getting arrested and demonstrating, and then they were never the same again. And you can take that scene and duplicate it again and again and again in Alabama and Mississippi and Southwest Georgia and all over the South in that period. Surprise the social scientists who had been studying this. The anti-war movement in Vietnam was a surprise. You know, how did it start off? A handful of people protesting here and there. What chance do they have against the mighty machine of the United States? Well, that little scattered protest that started in 1964, 1965 became an enormous national movement and did something that has rarely been done in modern history, and that is an internal movement of protest being a critical factor in helping to stop a war carried on by a mighty power. Surprises. Oh, we've seen surprises in Eastern Europe, right? And who expected those things to happen? You wake up one day and there are 1 million people in the streets. That gives you pause when you look at a situation and say, well, nothing is happening. People are quiet. I guess they don't care. I learned just going through that, going through the civil rights movement, the anti-war, I learned never to mistake silence for acceptance. You don't know what's going on underneath. You don't know what people are holding in. You don't know, people know what's being done to them. They're waiting for the right moment. They're waiting for somebody to make the first move. That's a big argument for people making first moves. You know. I came to the conclusion, that one of the reasons that very often people are surprised is because a lot of people seem to accept the idea that people are by nature sort of subservient, or by nature violent. It's interesting that those two things, it's a common paradox, double lies are told, which match. But people are not by nature warlike. They have to be driven to war. They have to be persuaded. They have to be cajoled. They have to be threatened. They have to be threatened with jail. They have to be driven into poverty so that they're desperate enough to join the armed forces. I mean, people don't rush off to war because they love to kill people. They have to work very hard at it. They have to control the media. They have to control the input. They have to create images of this wonderful war for liberation that do not correspond with reality, but that are dinned into people's ears again and again by all the modern means of communication. They have to work very hard to get people to go to war. They have to work very hard to get people to participate in the greed of a capitalist society. But people aren't naturally capitalistic. There isn't a gene for capitalism, So it's good to know these things. It's encouraging to know what potential there is in people, what people can do, what people have done from time to time. But in order for war to prevail, in order for an economic, an unfair, unjust, irrational economic system to prevail, in order for their policies, their, you know who I mean by their, them, those, no names, in order for them to prevail, they have to obliterate history. They have to get people so that people don't remember, don't study, don't remember even what happened 10 or 20 years ago. Don't remember that the women's movement was a great surprise. That the, there too, no help from the Constitution, no Equal Rights Amendment, no help from the White House, no help from Congress. The Supreme Court only comes through with Roe v. Wade after a women's movement has grown up in the country and changed the atmosphere. It's important when you begin to get depressed. A lot of my friends are depressed. I don't know if they're depressed because they're my friends. I don't like to think that. No, I think they're depressed because they read the state of the world through the eyes of CBS News, which does everything it can to obliterate historical perspective and to have us all be born yesterday. If you're born yesterday, you will believe anything that's said to you because you have no way of checking up on it. So if somebody says, well, we're fighting this war to liberate the Kuwaitis, well, of course, we want a war to liberate some. Yeah, but if you knew a little history, if you remember how we went into Cuba to liberate the Cubans in 1898, if you knew how we went everywhere to liberate everybody, and what the consequences were of those, or just a little bit of history puts you on guard against the statements of the political leaders and of the media. So it helps to have some perspective to be able to, no matter how tough things look, and no matter what terrible things are happening, and look at what a jury does in Los Angeles, and look at the manifestations of racism, very easy to draw up a whole list of terrible things to get us more and more depressed. But the fact is that there are things that are going on in this country, and there's a consciousness in this country today about many things that did not exist 30 years ago, really. If 30 years ago it was to think that, granted, the amount of discrimination against gay people, for instance, right? It's obvious. But 30 years ago, you didn't even talk about gay people. You discriminated against them quietly, not openly. But now the police chief of Portland, Oregon, hires his lesbian daughter as an officer on the police force, and to show his support for her, marches in two gay lesbian parades. The chief of police. Frankly, I used to be a little prejudiced against chiefs of police. But it shows how narrow-minded I was. But I was just talking to a friend of mine in San Diego, and he told me that the chief of police of San Diego just won a citation from the gay community of San Diego, and for his whole attitude on gay rights. He also told me, again, a matter of perspective, that. And San Diego, I remember as being, and I don't know, but I think it still has the reputation of being a conservative. Am I right? I know every place is conservative compared to Berkeley, but but no, San Diego is known as a conservative community. I remember being invited some 5 or 6 years ago there to give a commencement address or something, and people warned me, your life is in danger in San Diego. Giving a commencement address? You don't know San Diego. And then my friend tells me, he says, this is interesting. He says, here I am in San Diego. You and I are going to have breakfast tomorrow morning. That's where I'm going tomorrow. In this restaurant in the gay district of San Diego. And then he tells me about the police chief, and he says, no, my state rep in San Diego is a woman. My state senator is a woman. My two California senators are women. And the mayor is a woman. Something has changed, So. You can tell things are changing. They don't change in a straight line, right? If they change in a straight line, it would be easy to tell. They zig and zag and they confuse us, But they do change. Well, it's good to keep in mind that very often the other side, the people on top, the people in control, have a better sense of the power of ordinary people than these people themselves have. That's why they get so hysterical. Right? I mean, why do they have why have they had all these years the FBI rushing around taking everybody's name? They're scared. They're always scared. You know, they're worried. You know, why does Nixon go when there's one picket going around the White House during the Vietnam War, and Nixon goes bananas? Right? Do you remember? And have you noticed how those of you who have ever been on even a little picket line, and suddenly there are 12 cops around? To surround three people, you know, what are they getting excited about? They know that little acts lead to big ones. They know that. They know that any little thing that people do might lead to something else. They know that great movements come out of countless tiny acts that people engage in. Sure, there are people who do heroic things, and that's wonderful, but very few people can do heroic things, but most everybody can do something small. And the small things, which are unknown, you have to look hard in history to see these links and roots and connections, but the small things that people do connect with other things, and you don't even know when you do something small. Whatever you do, whether you sign a petition or stand on a picket line or defy your boss or refuse military service or say something to somebody, you don't know what effect you're having and how things build up. But you know, they worry about it. That's why they worry about multiculturalism in the curriculum. This is, they worry about Marxist professors in the colleges. Marxist professors are taking over. I was very heartened when I read that. When I wanted to cheer myself up, I used to read J. Edgar Hoover. Because with him, the structure of society was always in imminent danger. So, just a few points, short points. I am looking at my watch. I don't see it, but I'm looking at it. It's important not to set deadlines for when something will be accomplished, when great changes will take place. It's a long struggle. I think it helps a lot to think of it as a long, ongoing struggle. And that the struggle itself is worth it. That it's worth it just to get together with other people and stand up for the things you want. Just to get together with other people so that you know that other people want the same things you want. They want a world without war. They want a world without national boundaries. A world without racism and sexism. A world where people share things, share the wealth. Let's go back to some of the great ideas of the so-called primitive, savage, barbarian Indian communities of pre-Columbian times, when they didn't get excited about mine and yours and private property, and when they shared things. It's possible to have a society like that. And it's always good to know that you're not alone. There are people, everywhere. Remarkable people everywhere. You're separated from them and you don't hear about them. You don't know that in Texas City, Texas, there are people who want the same things you do, or that in other parts of the world, that people want the same. But of course, they are everywhere. And it's good to know that. Yes, I believe we can be virtually optimistic. You know. So, thank you.
And that does it for this week's program. If you would like to join our campus campaign sponsoring school libraries across the country, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us at 1-800-735-0230. The program is written and produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer. The series is executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives, and I've also been your host, Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and past grants from the American Archive, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and partnerships with UC Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Internet Archive, Other Minds Archives, and the Freedom Archives. And also, the most important supporter is you, the Pacifica listener. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.
There. This is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio.